I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Big stories of the year, top 10 lists, lousy weather, all signs that the year is coming to a close. But stop for a moment, chill out, enjoy that time with friends, and crack open a great bottle of wine. You needn't go far to find one. Sure, you could browse the shelves for a great bottle from France, Argentina, or Spain, or you could go local and choose from one of the great wines produced here in the Kansas City region. This hour, wine expert Doug Frost shares some of his favorites, and we'd like to hear yours, too. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Jack Frost may be nipping at your heels this morning. During this hour, Doug Frost will be nipping away at you as well with some good information on regional wines that are winning awards and lots of fans in the process. Doug Frost is one of only three people on the planet to hold both Master Sommelier and Master of Wine titles. He's an international wine consultant to boot and host of Check Please on KCPT, and it's always a good day when Doug Frost is in the house. Happy holidays to you, Doug.
Thanks. Thanks, Steve. Back at you.
We're talking regional wines today, and you've been an advocate for regional wines for a very long time.
Well, I have. I think for me, it was to some degree, I have to admit that I've always been a proselytizer for wine in general.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like certainly when I started in my career about 30 years ago, wine was sort of something that people made fun of, if you will, or at least that people looked askance at because it was the, you know, the province of folks who stick their pinkies out when they when they taste and such. And we were very much a beer culture at that time. And I think that milieu informed my thinking, and a great wake up for me was many, many years ago being as one often does at some charity event and as one often is asked to do, one's pouring wine. And so I'm pouring some wine and I would have people come by my table and you know, it'd be like, you know, some large cattle call charity event. There may be 1,000 people there and people would shuffle past your table and kind of go, well, what do you have? Oh, wine. No, well, that's okay. I don't drink wine. You know? And then one day I still remember the experience, you know, of going, well, this is a Missouri wine. And people would stop and go, a Missouri wine? I'd be like, yeah. Is it good? I'm like, yeah. And I'd pour it for him. And it was like all bets were off. It was as if all obstacles had been just immediately moved aside. If only for, you know, the sort of regional pride that one has in finding out what is here. And it's, to me, it's never been a coincidence that California, which consumes the most wine, is also the place that has the greatest amount of wine tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So people feel comfortable with it. They see it not as some incredibly special, precious object, but as something that somebody makes and somebody grows. And so for me, you know, wine, especially as we start talking about regional wine, gathers together all these ideas that seem important to me, this idea of regional pride, this idea certainly of agricultural pride, of belief in the idea that something is grown here where we live and that we have a chance to consume it, to know the person who makes it, to take greater pride in that piece of land.
Well, I think for a lot of people, though, that's going to be a tough sell, this idea that Missouri and Kansas can produce good wine, because we associate it obviously so much with California, with France, with even Australia these days, because you've taught us that. But Missouri and Kansas, you know?
Well, sure. A Missouri grape grower or a Missouri winemaker will immediately attest to this idea that, you know, you go back 100 years ago, Missouri was the most important wine growing state in the country. Now, I always like to point out, I think that was for a week, maybe. at the same time, it's really true that several decades, at least in the latter part of the 19th century, Missouri was in the top three, top five, and it really depends upon what year you're looking at. But Missouri was very important, and part of the reason it was important was that a group of Germanic folks living in Philadelphia had decided that they wanted to build a new republic, if you will, out in the center of the prairie, and they chose this place called Hermann. And literally people were recruited to come from Germany, and they were intended to be craftspeople, and they were intended to be farmers, and they certainly were supposed to make wine because that's what one did in Germany, and that's certainly what that Philadelphia group thought, that group of Philadelphia investors thought should represent Germany at its very best. Now, of course, they recruited people often who didn't know the damnedest thing about how to actually grow and make wine, and the big issue was they didn't know how to grow and make wine in Missouri. Every place is different, and that's what makes wine exciting for people like me. We often use the term that wine is transparent, and by that we mean if you have a good, not great, but good quality wine, you can see where it was grown. It's not just the grape. It's not just, you know, whether it's red or white or sparkling, but you can actually taste something that helps you identify where it came from.
Yeah.
And that's weird and exciting.
Well, are you saying that a Missouri wine these days, Doug, a good Missouri wine can compete with the best of the California wines?
Yeah, absolutely. And
really?
I would add Kansas to the mix. And indeed, I'd have to say that Nebraska and Iowa and Oklahoma, there are 50 states growing wine, and to me there are about 30 to 35 states that are growing very good wine, wine that tasted under, you know, in fair and equitable conditions, that's to say blind. You know, it's the idea is that you take a paper bag and you put it over your head. No, you put it on the bottle, and then you know, you taste the wine without any prejudgment. That at least 30, if not 35, states make wines that I think could be tasted blind anywhere in the world, and knowledgeable people would say, "Well, that's very good wine. What is it? Where's it from?"
That's remarkable. That's going to surprise a lot of people, and to me, that's just absolutely remarkable here.
Well, it's a matter of, as I say, going back 120, 140 years ago, when that the group of German winemakers came over, they were struggling with a new landscape, and most importantly, they were struggling with a new group of pests and insects and viruses that made life difficult. So just bringing Riesling over from Germany, which certainly is an important grape in Germany, the most important grape there, wasn't going to work. So they had to find grapes that worked here, and over the last century or so, we've started to identify grapes that work in this part of the country, and those are different grapes typically than work in, let's say, northern Iowa or Minnesota. Each place has its ideal grapes, I think, ultimately.
Which state is the wine industry more further advanced, Kansas or Missouri?
Certainly Missouri. Missouri has been extremely progressive and very supportive. The Missouri Department of Agriculture has a program called the Grape and Wine Conference. They have a website called Norton Says. Norton is in the state official. State grape of Missouri is the Norton grape. Kansas is still, I think, struggling at times to embrace its alcohol beverage past. If you go back again a century, Leavenworth and the area around Leavenworth produced a great deal of wine, an enormous amount of wine. But Kansas, as many people know, is one of the first states in the country to embrace prohibition.
And that legacy still lingers to this day when it comes to the wine industry itself.
No question about it. It's difficult sometimes for government figures and state legislatures to embrace the idea that the government is supposed to be helpful. You know, it's one of the – I don't want to get too political
what
here. What a crazy concept. You know, I don't want to get too political
Merry
here.
Christmas. But this
idea, indeed. You know, this idea that government isn't supposed to pick winners and losers. Well, government does that all the time. You know, government is us. And so government is supposed to reflect what we think is important. If that is solar energy or what we think is something that should be on the wane, I don't know, call that polluting rivers, you know, the government is supposed to help us make activate our choices.
Yeah.
And so it has been in the past and not so recent past that in Kansas wine was seen as something that shouldn't be encouraged. Now, I always get frustrated by that because the Judeo-Christian tradition embraces wine in its very heart. I mean, the sacrament is all about tasting wine and believing that, you know, this is something that God gave us. But that goes way, way back to pre-Judeo-Christian times. Frankly, that the Greco-Roman cultures embraced wine as a gift from the gods and as a message from gods.
If our listeners are hearing laughter that goes beyond the laughter of Doug Frost and myself, they're accurate. They're hearing the voices of Alana Gordon, KCUR's health reporter, Bill Anderson, our program director, and Danny Alexander, who works here on Up to Date and 90 Mile View. And you're going to pour some wine soon and allow our very sophisticated tasters here to check out this wine and sort of see.
Take the bag off now.
Yeah. offer their own thoughts on these different things that they're tasting here. What vineyards should people be looking for when it comes to good Missouri wine?
Well, certainly, I guess I'll start with Kansas, if I may, just because
sure.
it's a shorter list right now. I mean, Missouri has over 100 wineries, and Kansas
Missouri
is closing
has 100 on, wineries?
Yes, absolutely. And Kansas is closing in on about 30 or so. In Kansas, I look to Somerset Ridge. I obviously look to, you know, sort of the old boys there of Holyfield. Also, Blue Jacket Crossing has been a winery that's fairly recent and has done some really nice stuff, and they're very close by. There's also Stone Pillar, which is out in Olathe. So, you know, there's good things happening on the Kansas side. Of the Missouri side, the list, in a way, just goes on and on. Wineries like Stonehill and St. James were, you know, the wineries that people often thought of, but now, no matter where I go in the state, there are wineries, I think, that are you know, well worth our attention. And in this area, we have wineries like Jowler Creek, and certainly we have, well, you know, as I say, the list goes on and on.
Well, how well established is the whole wine tourism business now in Missouri? I know people think of Herman often, but how good a time can you have by touring Missouri vineyards and wineries on any weekend during the summertime?
Well, I think it depends upon if you've got a driver or not. You know, that's going to cut into your fun.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody has to be the proverbial designated driver. And I think that tourism in America in general, and certainly one could say in Kansas and Missouri as well, is built to a degree that is unparalleled in the rest of the world. I mean, the rest of the world hasn't quite wakened up to this idea of wine tourism yet. But following the lead of California, Missouri and Kansas wineries have figured out that you've got to be a nice host. You have to have a fun environment. Most of the environments tend to be very folksy, very, you know, sort of rough shod, and in a way much more sophisticated than they appear, but that's part of the charm of it. You know, you really are in any winery, unless you're going to the very biggest and brightest in Napa Valley, you're often walking into a place where you're talking to the farmer himself or herself.
Yeah.
And that's fun. I mean, you know, to me, that's really fascinating because there are so many disconnects. There are so many barriers between us and the things that we consume that wine at its very best, and, you know, certainly local wine ought to be about saying, no, I grew that right here, mm-hmm. and here's how I made it into wine, and here's where I bottle it, and here's where I pour it for you, and you tell me if you like it or don't.
We're talking about good wine this hour with Doug Frost, one of three people in the world who hold a dual designation of Master of Wine and Master Sommelier. He lives in Prairie Village. And it's interesting to note here, he's poured our first glass of wine that we're going to taste here, and none of our three tasters officially waited for the starting gun. They've already imbibed very quickly before Doug gave the green light.
Well, may I say that it's because it's in a brown paper bag, Bill felt a little more comfortable than usual.
And what have you poured here, Dr. Frost?
Well, it's a brown paper bag wine. I mean, before I can tell anyone, I have to ask you what you think.
Okay.
So
okay.
That's the important part. You know, for me, there is no I strive to convince people that the only arbiter of taste is your own palate, your own brain. So if you don't like it, that's cool. If you like it, that's great. The one request I always make of people is taste it twice, because so often the first taste is a little bit bracing. If like many people, you're just not far from a cinnamon roll or Colgate or whatever it is, you know, wine's a little bit of an adjustment.
Yeah.
So you take that second taste. And then the question I always ask people is, you know, what fruits do you taste when you taste this wine?
This is Danny. I just my nose, the nose on this is wonderful. That was the first thing. That's why I asked you for the cork. And the minute I smelled that cork, I was like, ooh. Boy, I could just, you know, I don't even have to drink this. I could just smell it.
It is
a lovely.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And
yeah.
It's.
That would be a great waste, Danny.
It would. But I do like the balance on this very well. It's got a lovely balance. And so it's. in terms of if I was thinking of serving this to guests, I wouldn't have to worry about somebody being offended that it might be have too much tannin or it might be too sweet or it might be too – it's just that nice.
It's kind of a neutral.
It's got a great balance but a very – a bit of a rounded flavor to it. And I always have a hard time identifying fruits. I can smell, but I'm not quite sure what it is that I smell sometimes.
So you are so good at describing wine. All these adjectives you're using. I just, where does this come from in your life?
Well, yeah, I grew up in a family that was very much when you had dinners or occasions, you had cocktails before dinner. You always had at least one wine with dinner, sometimes two, depending on the courses. You might have a wine with the entree and then a dessert wine, and after dinner, liqueurs. So not that I was ever conscious of wines, but it was just always something my parents were very responsible in teaching us, drinking at home. So I've always had wine with meals. I mean, that's the way I learned it. So, but as I've gotten to listen to Doug more often, I've learned these little terms like, oh, that's what I'm tasting. So, and I'm trying to remember the wine I had the other day, and I could actually smell the apple in it, you know, which was also a lovely tone.
Well, and now for the definitive word on this wine, we turn to KCUR's program director, Bill Anderson. William?
Unlike Danny, on the other hand, I grew up with Mogan David, so I came to wine late, and I do like it, but I do have trouble describing it at times, like you, Steve. You said neutral. I would say smooth.
Yes, very smooth.
And it's not too sweet. I don't care for the sweeter tasting wines, and I don't taste that. Again, I as Danny described, I like the nose. It seems kind of fragrant to me, and it's a. I find it. I would drink this on a regular basis. I like this.
Wow.
Yeah.
Alana Gordon, KCUR's health reporter.
Well,
please.
So I. So my. You know. Initial reaction is that it, you know, while it doesn't seem sweet at first, there is kind of a heaviness to it to me. And so I think about if I were having that with food or something, that it might be a little overpowering.
Sure. And would it matter which food? I mean, are you thinking more along the lines of fish or more like chicken or?
Yeah. I think that it's a nice taste, but I think for me at least, it feels a little bit heavy.
Interesting.
To my way of looking at it, it is a rather neutral wine. I think that it's essentially dry.
Yeah.
There's probably a tiny bit of sweetness to it, but it's pretty mild. But it is also, there's certainly, to Alana's point, there's this rather viscous texture to it. It's a reveal, as we say. This is Kansas Chardonnay, and it's from Somerset Ridge. And Chardonnay is...
Which is where?
Somerset Ridge is, in Miami County, all of maybe 40-minute drive. It's a really fun place to visit, as a matter of fact. They make some very lovely wines. And I wanted to bring a dry, if you will, white wine, because so often people say, that local wine's too sweet for me. I'm like, well, not all of them. Stop drinking the sweet ones then, If you don't like sweet wine, don't drink sweet wine. It's crazier world, isn't it? Chardonnay, is a grape that one can connect to the Chardonnay grape. But like most of the other grapes that grow around here, we're more likely to use grapes that are a hybrid crossing between grapes that are native to the Americas and grapes that are native to Europe or Eurasia. Chardonnay is a grape that's native to Eurasia. So it's been, hybridized with other grapes, including Sauvignon Blanc, and you come up with this name Chardonnay, which I always have to great Tom Stevenson, British wine writer who always describes Chardonnay as Chardonnay in hell. and it's just not fair anymore. But the truth is, for a long time, Chardonnay, everybody was trying to make it into Chardonnay, so they put lots and lots of barrel to it, if you will, put it in brand new barrels, and it's not a grape that can handle that. It has a lot of texture, but it doesn't have a lot of flavor. And so the smart people like Somerset Ridge, I think Les Bourgeois makes a lovely Chardonnay as well, Stonehill, places like that, they just let it be kind of like an un-oaked Chardonnay. And it's really nice that way. This is perfectly fine that way. But it is, to Alana's point, it is kind of a heavy wine. It just doesn't have a lot of flavor to handle.
It doesn't have a lot of flavor.
Doug, I see 2010 on the label. So what difference would I see in a 2012?
Well, you wouldn't see it quite yet. It's not quite done. I mean, you know, it takes 3 or 4 months minimum to go through the fermentation process, let that wine chill, and that's in the vernacular. So by that, I mean mellow out, sort of come together. The 2012 is going to have more fruit. Exactly to your point, Bill. It's going to have more of that overt kind of pear apple fruit. But I think this had some fruit, just not a great deal.
Yeah.
Doug Frost is in the house. We're talking regional wine. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Your questions about what to serve this holiday weekend, completely open and on the table here. Our email address, up-to-date, at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page.
So, Doug, I do have to ask, because he was just asking what a 2012 would be like, and I'm thinking with the drought and the weather that we had, you would probably taste a vast difference if you were to stand it next to this bottle.
Yeah, I think the 2012 vintage actually was fairly good for making high-quality wine, because everything's very concentrated. But it was pretty bad for farmers trying to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one of those things that farming is an unforgiving vocation. And certainly what has happened, in the last several years has been very challenging, whether it is the incredible moisture pressures that we've seen in some of the really wet summers or the incredibly dry summer that we just had. It's tough on farmers, but it does tend to, and what we saw last year, tended to concentrate grapes and flavors, and that was generally a good thing other than it made it harder to make wine. The wines had to go up in price a little bit, and it certainly challenged farmers.
And they brought grapes in from other locales, correct?
Not so much this year,
okay.
Although that is an increasing situation. Kansas just changed their rules to allow a Kansas farm winery to bring in an increasing amount of wine from outside of the state. And I tried to be as vocal as I could be against that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, my word holds a lot of sway, you know, really a lot of influence here. But it is that, to me, we were mortgaging short-term interests long-term interests away in terms of short-term gain, because it is easier to start a winery if you can bring in grapes from the outside. But you'll never build, in my opinion, a long-lasting, strong, and stable foundation to a wine industry unless you have grape growers who are getting paid a reasonable amount of money for what they do, wineries that are buying those grapes and then selling them at a reasonable price. All the channels, as it were, all the levels of the industry have to be healthy. And when you can bring in grapes from outside, there's a whole lot of really cheap grapes that you can buy from the Central Valley in California, and you can pretend that you're a winery because you bring in Chardonnay. And I know that I'm insulting some wineries when I say that, but I honestly think, you know, the point of wine is to, as I say, reflect place, to give some reason for people to go out to Central Missouri or Central Kansas or what have you and visit an actual winery.
Lori writes us with this comment. We visited a new winery that did not have their own grapes for press yet. They were, however, selling their label with grapes bought from another winery. Wanting to support a local business, we felt a little cheated. How do you know you're buying wine actually grown by that particular winery?
Well, in the case of, let's say, the Somerset Ridge, it says Kansas right on the label. There's a wiggle room, and sometimes that wiggle room can increase or decrease. You know, every state has its own set of rules. However, if it says Kansas on there, it's supposed to be grown primarily in Kansas.
You can probably count on that?
Yes, you can. You can very much count on that. What will happen is if it's not grown in Kansas or in Missouri or Iowa, what have you, it'll say American on there. That's the rubric that allows you to buy grapes from anywhere, blend them together, and call it your own. And I'm not, you know, there are perfectly good wines made that way, and I understand that somebody may need that foundation to get started. But those things have a habit of lingering. And so I have always been somebody who's tried to, as much as I can, focus upon wines that come from or grown in that state or that region.
I do appreciate when they tell you ahead of time, though, that they've brought grapes in from other states.
Yeah, and people have to make a living.
Doug Frost is in the house. He's a master sommelier. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Let's go to Alex from Kansas City, Missouri. Alex, happy holidays to you. Good morning.
Happy holidays to you, too. As you can hear from my accent, I come from Europe. In Europe, Missouri grapes they have a very special place, which, of course, your expert, Mr. Frost, will certify. What happened in the 1870s in Europe, there was an epidemic of phylloxera, which is a disease caused by a small insect, almost decimated the French vineyards. And what happens, it was an American entomologist that proposed a solution to take Native American rootstock or grafting to move to Europe. What we have today in Europe when it comes to vineyards, it's almost 90% coming out of Missouri
as
of 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
What a great story, Alex.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, Alex. It's remarkable. I mean, the rootstocks these days, you're just as likely to buy them from California. But they came originally from Missouri, from Arkansas, from Louisiana, from Texas. We have people like Hussman in Missouri. We have people like T.V. Munson in Texas, who were, as you say, early to the idea that, look, if the phylloxera bug came from the United States and it doesn't kill American vines, then maybe we should plant American vines. Oh, those make not so great wine. Let's go ahead and plant American vines, chop them off at the topsoil, and then graft European vines onto those American roots. So exactly to your point, 90-95% of all the world's wines are planted onto American rootstock to prevent phylloxera from destroying them.
Again, our number 816-235-2888. Alex, thank you for the call. Mike from Olathe. Mike, you're on Up to Date with Doug Frost this morning. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I have a quick question. I'm not a wine connoisseur by any stretch of the imagination, but when I was in college, I had the chance to go to Italy for 6 weeks at summer school, and we actually took a road trip up to the town of Frascati and pulled off the road to what looked to be like a farm, but it turned out to be a winery. And when they served it, I mean, basically it wasn't anything fancy. They had picnic tables and stuff, but they served wine. I understand it was tapped directly from the casks, and it was cloudy and full of pulp, but it was also the best tasting thing I'd ever had to drink. And I was told that you can't get that type of wine normally because I guess the pasteurization process does something to it. But, you know, I'm just curious about, you know, what was it about wine straight from the cask that hadn't been processed that made, at least to me, maybe tasted so much better than wine that I can get from the bottle. And Frascati is still my favorite wine today.
That's a great, great story too, Mike.
Yeah, Mike, it couldn't have been any fresher. Anybody who's been to Europe hopefully has found a way to have that same or similar experience because it really is quite exciting. You're having the wine as fresh as you can possibly have it. Now, one of the reasons I sit here and talk about regional wine is because we have the same opportunity. We can go directly to the winery. Frascati is a...
Well, I thought wine was, in theory, better aged. You get a 2004 or a 1994. There's something about that adds value to it as opposed to what you're saying right now.
It totally depends upon the wine. There are some wines, and it's a limited list, really. There are some wines that age well, but most wines aren't intended for aging. Most wines are intended to be consumed quickly. And Frascati is such an interesting story, really. It's a grape called Trebbiano, generally speaking, although sometimes we'll see a couple of other grapes there. But traditionally, it's been a forgotten wine, a forgotten grape. And what's been fun over the last 10 or 20 years is that a handful of producers, a very tiny minority of Frascati producers, have been making really high-quality Frascati. And they've accepted that part of the deal with Frascati is it doesn't age. Drink it fresh. Keep actually some of the CO2 that's the natural byproduct of fermentation in there. I mean, it's not fully sparkling, but it has a little bit of pétillance to it. Don't worry too much about getting it off completely off what we call the lees. Now, the lees are the dead yeast cells, and that's, you know, the yeast cells after they've done their work converting sugar into alcohol and creating a little of that carbon dioxide. And that's why your wine was a little bit cloudy, because those people were saying, look, fresh is cool. There's good flavor in amongst those dead yeast cells. And so I love going to Europe for those sorts of experiences. But as I say, you can have similar experiences here these days. This is something new for us here regionally.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, our master tasters will weigh in on how they feel about their second wine that Doug just poured. It's not a far cry from the first wine that we've sampled here, but we'll get an expert set of opinions as we come back here. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's Best Music of 2012 broadcast, you'll find it in our weekend to-do list at kcur.org. We're off tomorrow for Christmas, but join us on Wednesday for an encore broadcast of our conversation with the great writer Anna Quinlan. Well, this hour, Doug Frost is in the house. He's a master of sommelier, master of wine, one of only three people in the world who have those twin distinctions. We're sampling some great regional wines today and talking wine for the holidays. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Let's go. Bill Anderson, Doug Frost has poured us a second glass of good wine here. What do you think? Give us your expert.
For some reason, I'm having a really difficult time smelling this morning, but I will say that this tastes a little more. It's fruitier than the
yes.
Chardonnay.
Yes, it is.
When I swallow it, I have
a little more pucker.
I was going to say a small explosion of flavor.
It's like sweet sour kind of thing.
Yeah,
going on.
Yeah. But very desirable. And again, this would be a wine that I would gladly have at my table on a holiday.
Very well. Very well summarized.
I do have a question. Am I seeing legs? Is that what that
yeah,
is,
the,
Doug?
Yeah, the tears that form around the outside, the inside, of the glass really are just based upon really what is the differentiation between water and alcohol. They evaporate at different rates. They if you have a high alcohol wine, it'll cling to the glass more. You'll get a bigger teardrop running down the inside of the wine, the glass. It means nothing when
okay.
it comes to quality.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely zilch. Mm-hmm.
Alana Gordon, KCUR's health reporter. What did you think?
Well, I think now with the kind of the start with what we had earlier, this feels less neutral to me than the previous wine. So going from that, this has more of some sort of kick to it.
Mm-hmm. It is fruitier. It's a little sweeter. It's still not far from neutral, at least in my mind. Danny?
Mm-hmm. I thought it had a lovely personality, actually, yeah. compared to the first one. Sorry, I just had to take another sip.
It smells really good, doesn't it?
You get lost in it. And there's a particular note. See, and this
a little
is where
like
I,
chorizo.
This is where I fail because
I'm kidding.
There's
sorry.
A particular note that I'm catching, but I can't identify
it. It's floral. It okay. smells like somebody took, dried flowers, potpourri.
Right, yeah.
Only it's like white flowers or white roses. It smells like roses for sure.
Absolutely.
Either fresh or dried. It has a little bit of a smell like somebody's trying to perfume soap or something like that. I mean, I'm not saying it smells soapy, but it's so distinct that sometimes I get it that people go, oh, that smells kind of weird. I'm like, yeah, I know. But it's really distinctive.
Yeah.
It really is quite intense mm-hmm. for me.
Oh, that's great. Again, we're talking about great regional wines. Bill, I'll cut you off.
How much is that bottle of wine and how much was the Chardonnay again?
Oh, the Chardonnay, probably you could find it in most stores for, well under $15, more like $12.
Okay.
This next wine, I won't tell you how much it is until you tell me how much you like it.
Oh. How about the more recent wine that we just sampled?
This wine?
In terms of cost.
Well, in terms of cost, like I said, what do you think it's worth?
Oh. Probably $13.
Okay, well, nicely yeah. done, sir. Anybody else? Yeah, what we had here, this is a grape called Treminette. It's one of the real stars of the last 5 years in Missouri and Kansas wineries. Treminette has, a great, great future. It's, a grape that's been hybridized between a European variety called Gewürztraminer,
mm-hmm.
and that hence is why it has that, floral nose, and then some other grapes that are native to this part of the country. And so you put those two together, and the Treminette grape just does really, really well out in the vineyard. We've got another grape, too, that we're all raving about right now called Valvin Muscat, and it's like the Muscat grape, which is one of the most ancient of European Asian...
Valvin Muscat.
Yeah, Valvin Muscat. And the Valvin Muscat grape is like this grape only on steroids. It's turned up to 11. I mean, it's really, really floral. And I think it's fun. And so often it's not sweet. I mean, this one has a touch of sweetness, but really not that much. It's kind of more of a sweet sour experience rather than just a sweet wine experience.
Yeah. We have a good email here. Rick from Maryland writes us this. Help, my one sister-in-law, Julie from Westwood, will only drink Mad Dog 20, and my other sister-in-law, Gretchen, only will drink wine from California. How can I convince them to drink regional wine and also use deodorant? Thank you very much.
That's Rick from Maryland. I thought Mad Dog 2020 had been outlawed.
Yeah.
No, MD 2020 still around. You know, there's a place for all tastes, and it really is that people ought to be allowed to drink what they like. And if you like, you know, Mad Dog, go for it. And if you like California Cabernet, go for that.
And as people sort of weigh choices for big holiday feasts, that's always been your advice. There really isn't a magical answer for any one meal. You've even pitched the idea of drinking beer with your turkey if that's what you're choosing to have on Thanksgiving or Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the issue is what I usually try to do is just put out a few different wines so that everybody can find something they like. So I always have something that has some sweetness to it. Heck, I like sweet wines. I eat lots and lots of really hot food, whether Thai food or Sichuan or, you know, Mexican or Latin. And a sweet wine cools the fire better than a dry wine does. And, you know, certainly some people like red. One of my daughters likes red. One of them likes white. So, you know, I'm going to have both. And that, I think, is the key. If somebody likes a particular wine, have what – you know, a good host would have what it is that they like to taste. On the other hand, Rick, you know, if you really want to convince them – I've been known to go ahead and decant a wine into a different bottle, you know, so they can tell me how great this California wine is. And I can go, you know what's really interesting about this wine? It's not actually the right bottle.
Yeah. Wow. That'll show them.
It's evil. It's evil.
We're talking wine. We're talking great regional wines with Doug Frost. Again, our number 816-235-2888 and our email address update@kcur.org.
And one point I did want to bring up about regional wines, I find, is that the pricing is so good on them. I think they're really reasonably priced. I can always get a red or a white from one of the regional wineries, and it's always easy on the pocketbook. I hate to say that, but it's, you know, in this day and age and working for public radio, that's an important an important fact.
Yes.
But I always find the pricing to be very, very reasonable.
Yeah, I think the one exception here in this part of the country is Norton is a highly prized grape, and it's certainly a very distinctive grape. And it's, as I said before, the official state grape of Missouri. It can be a bit expensive. I mean, these days you're going to pay $20 or $25 for a Norton. Mm. And some people would say, look, for that much money, I'm going to buy something, you know, out of California. My attitude is always just buy something you like. But I certainly think that Norton has a unique profile. But I really like – there's another grape that grows in this area called Chamberson that you can usually buy pretty cheaply. And people like Augusta or Montel – I mean, and, you know, and others, they make just stupendous, I think, Chamberson.
We've poured our first red here. And I was going to say, you know, when I go to Costco, I still wish you were there to describe some of these different wines instead of those silly little cards they have there, which don't tell me anything about the product I'm considering buying beyond how pretty the label is. Doug, it drives me crazy.
Have you noticed this phenomenon? I was just buying wine, and I'm watching couples with the smartphones, and they're looking up the wines, and they're going to whatever site to see what. And I actually hear one husband saying to the wife, "Honey, I can't find it listed anywhere here." I'm like, "Really? That's I just go look, read the label, read where it's from."
I want more information. I don't know. I want a consumer's guide to how good this bottle of wine is.
No, I tend to. I'll take my chances if I know the type of if I know the grape. I'm willing to try it from different areas.
But people don't know the grapes, Danny. But most people
if you've had a Chardonnay before, you know a Chardonnay. My challenge is then try a different producer of the wine. If you know the grape and you like
but
the grape.
Your life every day is a new, brand new adventure.
Right.
Not everyone lives as dangerously as you do, Danny.
You know, I really just try to convince people that what they ought to do is create a relationship with a retailer and to go in, you know, if not once a week, but go in at least once a month and say, hey, you know, thanks a lot. You sold me this one. You sold me this one. I didn't like this one that much, but I love this one. Sell me something else like it. I think what has always driven me mad is to some degree, people walking around with a smartphone going, oh, look, honey, it's 94 points, you know.
Oh. Yeah,
according to whom? Are they coming over for dinner? Who cares,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
Are you going to like it? And then the same thing will happen. Well, somebody will tell me, well, I went, I drove across town because it was $1.50 less. I'm like, okay, do you know the price of gas? Does that make any sense at all? As opposed to I find a retailer who gets my taste who says, look, I don't know how many points this wine got, but I know what you like. You're going to like this. That's frankly, to me, irreplaceable.
Did anybody else, and when I first sniffed this, and please, I don't mean any offense, but when I first stuck my nose in this glass, I immediately thought that I was in Home Depot lumber section.
Oh, that's interesting.
I just kind of, there's wood or...
Sawdusty. There's a sawdusty sort of smell.
This is actually from Doug's Vineyard, so yeah, you did
it. There's not a lot of, it's not real pungent. Let's go, we have so many calls for Doug Frost, as is usually the case. Let's go to a couple phone calls here before we give our expert opinions here. Mary from Independence. Mary, you're on Up to Date with Doug Frost.
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call.
Happy holidays, Mary.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas,
okay,
indeed.
Mary.
You guys. Well, anyway, I grew up, I was born down in the Flint Hills years ago, of course. My dad, there was nine of us, and we'd go out and pick the wild grapes. So he would take them home, and I cannot tell you what kind of other grape he would mix with the wild grape. Well, it must have been doggone good, because Father Fitzgerald would come home with my brothers every Sunday. Hello?
Hello, yeah. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Well, I think that there is...
I mean, I was too young to taste it, of course, but Father Fitzgerald, every Sunday, he would come home with my brothers and my dad, and he would be underneath the apple tree.
That's awesome. I think that there is a long legacy of people making wine themselves, and officially speaking, you're not really even supposed to do that in the United States of America, which is kind of crazy, but I think we're loosening our restrictions on that sort of thing. And my family, or at least my father's side of the family, was Italian, and he would always talk about those stories that people would always have some wine fermenting down in the basement, and when they got together on Sunday, they'd bring the wine up and they'd taste it, and it didn't have to be the greatest wine in the world. It was pretty fresh, and that was what they did, and they, you know, that's certainly what their Italian heritage demanded of them, and if it brought the good father over to hang out with your family, that's pretty great, Mary.
Well, Danny Alexander, this is the first red we've tasted so far this hour, and talk to us.
Well, I tend to favor reds, especially for some reason, you know, colder weather, and I'm looking for reds. This doesn't have quite as much body as I like in a red. However, that being said, again, I think it's well balanced. It has a nice tannin. You get a nice.
Arguably, it's a little weak.
It's
really.
It gives mm-hmm. you a little pucker at the end.
A little pucker.
You know, it's not knocking my socks off, but it's not offensive. It's about the best I can do on that.
Bill,
I find it a little chalky.
Chalky.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like, you know, it's drying your mouth out like chalkwood. This wine, I have to kind of jump out in front and say, you know, it's a blind tasting. So we had to put everything in perspective. So this is a French wine. This is a blend of Cabernet and Syrah and Merlot and grapes like that from southern France. And it's a little chalkier. One, I know this is going to sound crazy, because the soils there are, in fact, limestone and a sort of precursor to chalk. But mostly because it's tannic. And it's one of the things that the red wines of this region, the hybrid grapes that we've been growing, haven't really quite created yet, that chalky, tannic feel.
So what you're saying is that Bill Anderson describing this wine as chalky was spot on.
Pretty much.
That word came out of left field and
nicely
he nailed
done.
It.
Nicely done, sir.
Alana Gordon.
Well, yeah, I mean, that came to mind too, kind of that kind of dry, like pucker at the end. Mm-hmm. So, but to me, you know, in my, I enjoyed kind of that neutralness to it too. It
I was going to say like, neutral sort of.
There is a balance something. To it, yeah.
Well, I think to some degree, the reason that I brought this wine was one, of course, because if you don't blind taste Kansas and Missouri wines against wines of you know, more notable wine producing countries, then we don't really know what's
not a good comparison.
Yeah, exactly. We haven't proven anything at all. But secondarily, I think that this is from the area known as Languedoc-Roussillon, which is the southern part of France. They make more wine there than any other part of France, and yet they're still not really sure which grapes they ought to be growing there. So you see a blend of grapes over and over again. And perhaps I exaggerate by saying they're not sure which grapes, because Grenache and Syrah have done quite well there for many centuries. Nonetheless, they're still casting around trying to figure out which grape. And my point is,
like,
so are we here. You know, that's what we're trying to do here, too. We're trying to figure out which grapes. They've had a lot more time to work at it.
And where's this from again?
This is Languedoc in France.
That's what I was going to say, Steve.
Okay, let's go to some phone calls here. Meredith from Kansas City, Missouri. Meredith, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Well, you know, I know that I like Shiraz and Shiraz blends. I know that I like Sauvignon Blancs. I've had a few, like I have some friends that would go out to one of the Kansas wineries and would always bring over a bottle of that to give to us at parties and things. I've been out to the winery that's out by Columbia, but I don't really know. I mean, with all these different kinds of grapes, I don't even know where to start. I mean, I don't know enough about the language of wines. Is there anywhere that has, like, you know, descriptions or comparisons or anything that would help me know if something was a wine that I would, you know, I would like to try?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we in the United States have been pioneers to some degree in focusing upon the grape variety. And so as Danny was talking about earlier, it's a Chardonnay is a Chardonnay is a Chardonnay. Well, of course, it isn't completely true, but it is that if you figure out what Chardonnay tends to smell and taste like and you like that, that you're likely to at least enjoy other Chardonnays from other places. It's one of the reasons, though, I really do recommend either going to a retail store that offers tastings, which we're seeing on an increasing level, or, again, going to a winery. Because at a winery, most wineries will say, well, we'll give you three tastes before we have to charge you. And some wineries will say, well, you know, we'll let you taste anything you want to taste as long as you feel like buying something. And you taste through 8 or 10 wines. And, yes, I always recommend spitting. You've noticed that I'm spitting as we go through here because, you know, I like to taste a lot of different wines. And that's the only way you can do so responsibly. You find the one you like, and then that's where you sit. You know, that's where you go ahead and drink that wine. But I think that it's kind of it's just an almost impossible task to imagine figuring out which wine you're going to like without tasting it first. Mm. And so it seems to me so reasonable, just ask for a taste.
Dale writes us this at UpToDate at KCUR.org. I'd stress just how fun it is to drive around even metro Kansas City and stop at a winery or two. Most have nice sitting areas, some with outdoor fire pits or heating that are enjoyable unless it's just bitter cold. These are just great destinations for an afternoon outing. And if you have more time, weekend trips are great. Where can you go, Doug, to find sort of a good list of wineries not far away that would be worth going to visit?
Well, not too long ago at the Kansas City Star, we did a piece about local wineries. And so you could certainly go online at kansascity.com and search out local wineries and find that article. Because there are any more, there are whole bunches of them around this area. And it's really exactly.
It's not just a summertime trip. At least that's what Dale's suggesting.
Yeah, I think Dale's right. I mean, you know, it's really fun to do around the holiday season if they're open. You want to call first and make sure that they've got, you know, that the in fact that, you know, they're going to be open while you're visiting. But it's really, really fun to do. As I say, you find somebody who wants to be the driver and everybody else can have a great time and argue, if you will, about what they like and what they don't like, because the bottom line is we're never going to like all the same thing. And so as long as nobody gets their nose out of joint over the fact that you like this and I like that, it turns into a lot of fun. You start to ask, you know, each other, well, why do you like it? What do you taste in there? Now, this wine that we're having right now, this is, in fact, a Missouri wine from Jowler Creek, which is a very nearby winery. And this is that grape I was
Jowler Creek.
Yeah, this is an older version too. This is it's 2009, but it's you know, you'll find out in the market right now 2010s and 2011s, and I think the Chamberson grape has a great future here. It's a sort of raspberry tone and cherry, but it is dry.
Blah.
I was just going to ask. You talked about you know, relationships with retailers and going to wineries. And I don't know if you're in a position to address this, but to what degree have you found, or has there been any development in terms of, if you're not going to a winery, if you're not going to a wine store, but let's say to a local restaurant or to an area bar or whatnot, and are you seeing that these relationships, these wines being kind of championed there or offered even? Because sometimes you would know.
Yeah, I think so. I think that increasingly Kansas City restaurants are waking up to the wines that are produced nearby and around them. And if you think about it only this way, that it is the greenest of green venture, you know, ventures to focus mm-hmm. on wines that are made within 50 or 100 or 200 miles. Indeed, we're seeing more and more of that. And you see it even at the very you know, pinnacle, if you will, amongst restaurants in the Kansas City area, like the American Restaurant. The American Restaurant has a section of Missouri wines, wineries and wines of which they're very proud. So, yeah, I think we're seeing that increasingly. It's always a challenge because I come back to the same argument that if a restaurant wants to focus on regional wineries, they must pour it by the glass. Nobody's going to buy a bottle of this stuff. Mm. You know, they're going to say, well, let me taste it first. And a restaurant is the ideal place to say, here, take a taste. If you'd like more, I'll pour you a real glass. Mm-hmm. If not, let's find you something you do like.
Danny, what did you think of this latest Missouri wine?
I'm impressed. Excellent nose on this. And just those nice fruity. Gosh, this is just nice. You could just drown your nose in it and never have to take a sip.
Yeah. William?
Doug, feel free to humiliate me on the air, but the first word that comes to mind is port.
Is it a little port-like for you?
It is.
Is it just because the...
He's being kind.
No. I'm just curious. The thing is that we all taste differently. Mm-hmm. And so when I ask people, you know, questions, it's like, okay, so in what way is it porty for you? For me, it's really intense kind of black fruits and even a little touch of blueberry in there. And that's not unlike port. On the other hand, I actually have a dessert wine where we kick the sweetness up. We kick the alcohol level up a little more like ports can be. So I wondered if it's the intensity of the fruit that's making you think about port.
Mm-hmm. And I think I sort of like this, but I believe if I were to try it again in a different setting, maybe not at 11:50 in the morning, I would like this a lot.
Let's go back to some phone calls. Folks have been waiting very patiently here. Hal from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy holidays, Hal.
Happy holidays. First, Doug, I want to thank you for your check, please. What a great show, and I've discovered some great gems of restaurants that I would have never thought about or probably gone to.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I get to eat there, too.
The wine that I wanted to talk about is one, and you talked about day trips. There's two places I like to go. Sadly, they're not in Kansas, but they are nearby. One is down around St. Genevieve, which... has four or five wineries on a country road that is very scenic, and you can taste the wines. Some of them have food available, and you can compact four or five different vineyards in one. But one I was pleasantly surprised at is a winery right outside Urick, Missouri, called Red Fox.
Mm.
You know, I
pass it all the time.
Yeah, I've only tasted one wine from them. I guess I need to revisit their wines because I have not. I haven't really gotten to know them yet.
Hal recommends Red Fox Vineyards. Let's go to Wesley very quickly. Wesley, we're short of time. Good morning.
Morning. I just want to quickly say no one has mentioned anything about St. James Winery. If you like the reds but you don't like the Cabernet taste, I would recommend one. I believe it's called Schoolhouse Red. It's very smooth. Mm-hmm. And it's not dry.
Yeah, indeed. The Traminette that we had here is St. James. You know, they do really good work. And another one I hadn't mentioned that I meant to was Stonehouse Farms, which is out in Lee Summit. I mean, you know, couldn't get much closer. They're making really solid wines these days.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, we are out of time. But, boy, Doug, we sure appreciate your time. Always good to have you here. Great recommendations. And we sure appreciate you coming in.
And happy holidays to everybody.
You bet. I want to thank Bill Anderson, Alana Gordon, Danny Alexander for coming in here as well today, too. You'll find a complete list of the wines we sampled today and more information about our guests and our program at kcur.org. We're off tomorrow for Christmas, but join us on Wednesday for an encore broadcast of our conversation with writer Anna Quinlan. Up-to-date's theme music is by Bobby Watson and the UMKC Conservatory of Music Concert Jazz Band. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman and Danny Alexander. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.